Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review on this Friday. I'm Bill Radke. This is the hour where we look back at what happened this week and figure out what it means and what to do about it. And I'm so happy to be here with Zeki Hamid of Humanities Washington, Pamela Banks of the Urban League, Bill Finkbeiner, former Republican state senator. Welcome, team.
Thank you for having me.
Good day.
Let's get at it. This week, the Seattle City Council voted on whether to vacate a street in Soto for a new sports arena. Councilmember Lorena Gonzalez, you are the swing vote. It's four yay, four nay. How do you vote?
Today I am going to vote no on the street vacation.
And so the street stays a street, not for a sports arena, which means, Zeki, it is less likely now that there's ever going to be a Seattle Sonics again. How does that feel?
Well, as a sports fan and as a Sonics fan, it's absolutely infuriating. But I want to say it's not infuriating because of that particular vote. The infuriating thing for me is that in a world-class city like Seattle, and with private money backing this arena, we still can't figure out how to build and where to build an arena. That, to me, almost encompasses the Seattle process in a way, and it's just really, really infuriating. So when I heard the vote, I wasn't too surprised that this is the way it went. And the second point is that I think it's really disappointing that it fell on gender lines, because that gives a lot of ammo to people to be misogynistic towards the women that voted no.
And that happened. We're going to talk about that, yes, in just a moment. Bill Finkbeiner, Zeki mentioned the process. You were part of the process.
Yeah.
You've been a state lawmaker. Can, as Zeki said, there was private money behind this deal. Is it even possible to have a nothing but privately funded arena where the public and taxpayers are nothing is asked of them?
Yeah, I don't think that's really possible. When you build these arenas, they have to be built in urban areas, which means you're going into a dense, expensive place that's got existing infrastructure. So, I don't know that you could ever build an entirely private arena that would need no government approvals, you know, short of putting it out in Carnation or something like that, right? It just doesn't make sense. So it's always going to be some kind of a partnership with government. This one, the thing about this one is it really is asking so much less of the city and of government than all the other stadiums that have ever been built. So it's really amazing that we've sort of come so far that they, even with as much private investment and as much as the private sector stepping up for this arena, that is still not being built. It's really kind of sad.
Pamela Banks, you ran for city council. You could have been in one of those chairs. And how would you have voted?
You know, it's pretty funny. I actually saw Councilmember Burgess at the housing levy kickoff campaign, and I said, I would have went with the guys because, like Zeki, I'm a huge sports fan. However, I do think about we don't have a team, and I think about the impact it would have in that area right now. I'm worried about commerce, very concerned about the port, what's going on with, goods and services in and out of that area with the other two arenas. So I thought about that, too. I said, how would have I voted? And I think at the end of the day, I probably would have voted for it because I'm this huge sports fan. And I worked for Mayor Nichols when the Sonics lost it. I left and I cried when they left because of that impact to the community.
Tell us why it's okay to vote for, in this case, vacating Occidental, because you're a sports fan. I mean, you could argue that's the wrong reason to vote for something.
I'm really with Bill on the thought that there was so much private money in this this deal, and I think that it goes back to what Zeki said. This whole public process, we process things to death, and so that's the part that kind of irritated me. So I'd say personally, I would have voted because I'm a sports fan. But realistically, it's like, will we ever get this deal again? The other thing that I think Councilmember Bagshaw brought up too about it was, is there a possibility for the remake of Key Arena? I mean, I remember the Ackerley's, was trying to build down there decades ago, right? And then you turn around and you have all this controversy, and it's, we have this beautiful Key Arena. They had an EIS that said it could potentially be done, and so it's a partnership. And then I think now we're so far away, it's like we'll never get a team again because of this vote.
Zeki, Key Arena.
Yeah, so the thing is about Key Arena is the Soto Arena as well. It's not just about sports. It's about so many other events, and especially music events. It's so hard to load in and out of Key Arena for bands that they usually have to have a day off the next day if they're going to come to Key Arena, because it's so hard to load in and out. So it would have been so much better if we had this Soto Arena, because Key Arena is not viable. Tacoma Dome is absolutely disastrous.
Why?
it just feels like a high school stadium. The sound is terrible. Getting there is terrible. Parking is terrible. It's, you know, it's falling down. It's just a terrible place to see a show. I mean, and I.
What's the best place in the Northwest to see music?
The Gorge.
Yeah.
By far.
Agreed.
That is the most beautiful place I have ever seen a show. And I used to tour with the band Phish back in the 90s.
Really? Doing what?
Oh, just go ahead and sing shows.
Oh, sing shows. I thought you played bass.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
No, you. Okay,
I would have had a lot more money by now.
Played the air bass.
Right.
I played the air drum, the air bass, the whole thing.
You followed him around.
Yeah, I followed around. So I see you know, tons and tons of great music venues. Nothing beats the Gorge.
All right. Yeah. Now, you can be against the Soto Arena deal and still feel sad about no more Peyton and Detlef and Kemp and Slick Watts and Championship and all that stuff. I want to talk now about the misogyny that Zeki brought up. All of the council members who voted no on this street vacation are women. One of the milder Facebook reactions was, this is why women get paid less than men at this level. Irrational / emotional thinking takes precedent over reason in important decision making. From there, it got nasty, way nastier, and even violently misogynistic in some cases. Pamela, the mayor objected to that kind of talk. The stadium developer objected to it. How did you react personally?
I was appalled. I was really, really appalled that it, you know, and the key, though, the thing that I thought of was when I heard the vote went like that, I was like, wait till the comments come, because I thought it was going to come just the things that I experienced when I ran for council. So it didn't surprise me, truth be told.
What did you experience?
We're gonna jump to Trump, but I think this whole thing around Trump and all this visceral, you know, just misogynistic, racist comments, I really feel like the last 8 years with having a black president, it started coming up. I think Trump has just made it seem like it's okay. And so when this vote happened, it did not surprise me. Now, the violence surprised me, but I thought there were going to be a lot of negative comments because it was women against men.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, speaking of women against men, Bill Finkbeiner, you were in the state Senate. Did you or other men get the same level? It's not the same vitriol, but the same level? Did you find that in your experience?
You know, I think it's changing. Sort of the nature of, like, feedback, political feedback is changing with social media and comment things and stuff like that. There were a couple votes, you know, where I got, I mean, I never took them seriously, but we got a couple death threats and definitely, you know, a lot of. Remember, after one in particular, it just came in the next morning and just, you know, 300. But they were voicemails back then, so they were so much easier to ignore.
What was the topic?
Public.
Do you remember?
The two that I remember that really got people the most angry was the gas tax and then the civil rights bill. Those were the two that really and the gas tax surprised me. But, both of those were the two that really made people, you know, for at least for my vote. And it's always tough when it's a close vote. When votes aren't close, it doesn't seem like people get as angry. But when they're one vote away,
right,
then that seems like it just people get more upset.
I want to get back to misogyny, but I just want to know, I always wondered, how do you handle a death threat? I mean, you take it seriously? You don't take it seriously? Let's say you take it seriously, what do you do?
Those weren't, I never took seriously, but there were other people who got death threats while I was in the legislature that they did take seriously. And basically, for the legislature, the state patrol steps in and listens to it and decides whether it's something serious or not. And, you know.
Okay.
So it happens.
Pamela, this, as we said, nasty, sometimes violent words directed at the women on the city council who voted no on Occidental Avenue. To you, is that just online flaming? By the way, the irony is that this was men being emotional. You know, it's sort of ridiculous to read all the, you know, men ranting about how emotional women are. But do you look at it as flaming and it is what it is? And you talked about the reasons for it, perhaps, and Donald Trump, et cetera. But what do you think, if anything, we should do about it?
I ignore it. I think that when we put it in the media and we continue to talk about it, I think it just they get that attention. So it's almost like, you know, people that, you know, copycat.
Really?
So, yeah.
Would you rather we not even be talking about that?
Well, I mean, no, I think it's an important topic. in the reason why the time that we're in. But I think in hindsight, when you think about how the media, I mean, the reason that Trump is how he is because it's a lot of with the media, right? And so I think when you continue to almost pat people on the back or give them that voice, it and further inflames it. And so for me, again, it just saddened me because I was thinking, this is a basketball arena, a hockey arena. This is not, we're not, you know, saving lives or, you know, we're not, you know, putting people, you know, ending homelessness. This is about an arena. And so we can't. You know, and I love it, Bill, that you said this is about men being emotional because it was a lot of men. And there was a video that someone just told me about that there were two women sportscasters.
ESPN.
Yeah, that they just did. And they sat down and talked to men about these women sportscasters were getting all these negative comments because they're women. You don't belong here. You need to go do something else. And one of them had actually been raped. And one of the men said to her, not the men that were listening to their story, but had said she needed to get raped again and get off the air. That stuff is just crazy to me. And so I think that we need to be a little bit more maybe conservative about how much we go out there, you know, inflaming things like this, because I think that people feel like I got noticed because I was so far to the craziness on this issue.
One of the things we've heard, we're going to wrap this topic up, but one of the things we've heard a lot over this Black Lives Matter movement is people of color being asked what we should do and answering, you figure it out for a change. You know, white people, you know, what are you going to do? Why are you always asking us? So, Zeki, what do you want to say as a man about what, if anything, ought to be done about this kind of misogyny?
Yeah, well, I just want to say that this is nothing new. Lindy West, if you remember from Seattle, has gone through this and many, many times, death threats, misogynistic views. The founder of Feminist Frequency is commonly attacked. This happens a lot. It happens a lot because of social media also, because of the anonymity of it at all. But I think in case of what to do, it's on us. And it's on us men. This is the thing. For us men who are feminists have to step up, say we are feminists, explain what that really means, stand up for women's rights, and call it out wherever we see it, especially with friends and family. It's not funny. It's you know, it's no longer a joke. So we have to say we are not going to tolerate it anymore. We constantly have to stand up, declare we're feminists, and because the solution can only be from us.
Feminist Zeki Hameed is Program Director for Humanities Washington, a nonprofit that gives and promotes art and humanities programs around Washington State. Pamela Banks, Bill Finkbeiner, Bill Radke here on the Week in Review. And coming up, there may or may never be a President Trump, but just the possibility is shaking up the Washington GOP. We'll talk about that in 20 minutes. KUOW's Week in Review. Thanks for tuning in. This week, KUOW began a new series on the Seattle homeless encampment known as The Jungle and the people who live there.
For most of us, by the time we've gotten here to the point where we're living under a bridge in tents, we feel very much alone and kind of a displacement and a separation from society. And when you're on the streets, there's absolutely no normalcy at all. There's no routine. And so when I found this place, it had been so long since I felt safe and welcomed.
Meanwhile, if you have a home in Seattle, it's now worth $637,000 on average. That's new numbers out this week. Is that fair? Because your idea of fairness can dictate what you do. Should we build more homes, get more dents, keep it the way it is? Pamela Banks, what is fair?
I think fair is the opportunity that everybody has access to a home or a safe environment. And what's going on in our city is very, very scary. I live in the Central District. We're getting ready to have a big development built literally a block from my house. I'm concerned about, I don't mind density. I live in an urban center. I chose to live in the Central District. I can walk to work. I can walk to my grocery store. I used to walk to my gym and my dry cleaners before they closed. But
you think they closed as part of the gentrification?
Part of gentrification, part of the development that's coming in. The leases were up and so forth.
Uh-huh.
But I and so my backyard is literally Judkins Park, Washington Middle School, in the bakery. I want density because I want the opportunity for more people to be able to live and work and play in this city. I don't like that people are having to drive 2 hours in and 2 hours out. That is not a quality of life. And so I think fairness is that we, the city, figure this out and that we give people opportunity to move back into the central core of the city or the city limits in and of itself. And then we have to do a better job of, you know, we talk about, you know, we got light rail coming and we talk about transit oriented development, but we have to do job creation in places where people live so that they're not having to make that trek. And so, you know, my condo that I bought 20 years ago, I couldn't afford it on my salary today as a nonprofit CEO. And that worries me because I want to retire there. I want to stay there. And I worry about, am I going to be able to afford the property taxes, you know, with my retirement? And so we definitely need to get on this. We definitely need to figure it out. And I think that, you know, I'm co-chairing the housing levy campaign. And we public have to do it, but we have to do it with partnership with private development. The city, we can't build our way out of this situation that we're in. We totally can't do it on our own.
We're talking about fairness. Bill Finkbeiner, you live in Kirkland, single family house?
Yep.
Is it fair or unfair to say, I want to live in a suburban city. I want to live, whether it's in Kirkland or I want to live in Wallingford with a lawn and a driveway or free curbside parking. That's why I moved here. Is there something unfair about that?
No, I think that's perfectly fair. I do think that all areas, though, are going to need to become more dense if we're going to expect that housing not even be affordable, but at least not get that much worse.
How about your neighborhood?
So
do you want it to be more dense?
In my neighborhood, it needs to be more dense. Now, obviously, you're not going to go build, you know, a skyscraper in a single family neighborhood. But you're not going to build a skyscraper in a neighborhood that's got a bunch of two-story buildings either. It's a two-story buildings go to three stories, and a suburban neighborhood starts to get mother-in-laws behind it, and you know, and maybe smaller lots, and dense areas where they have 15-story buildings, maybe they start to go to 20. I mean,
well, less really short of a skyscraper, if your street's rezoned for townhomes, your street.
Yeah.
You're telling me you don't oppose that?
No, I don't. I think for a few reasons. First of all, I think density adds a lot to a lot of neighborhoods. It brings back the ability to start to be able to walk to places. All of a sudden, restaurants and the dry cleaners and that kind of thing, they can actually afford to, you know, to open up there. And whereas when you're not dense enough, then you end up with a bunch of houses and no sort of other infrastructure. And you're driving to the schools and you're driving to the grocery store. Denser neighborhoods make that better. And again, you know, it's not like you're going to get an 80-story building. But also we have to look, and when you ask about fairness, you know, if we don't increase the supply, it's supply and demand. And obviously demand's increasing. If we don't increase supply, there's only one thing that's going to happen, and that's that prices are going to continue to go up. And they'll probably continue to go up no matter what we do potentially, but at least they'll go up a lot less if we start to add supply in a real way.
People talk about San Francisco. Zeki, I can't afford to live in Medina either. Is it unfair to have some places be affordable and some places? What if Seattle just becomes unaffordable like San Francisco? Is it unfair?
I don't know if it's unfair. You know, we don't want Seattle to become like San Francisco because San Francisco is like a playground for the rich. And there's a lot of people that need to stay here. And it would be terrible if anybody who does not make six figures all of a sudden has to move out. I mean, I have these fantasies of, you know, moving to Wenatchee or something like that, where it's like it's just open space and everything like that. But then I remember how much I love cities, and I said, like, nah, never mind. I'm going to stay here. But, you know, this really interesting, there was a study that was released, I think, last week that was saying that most Americans are not as concerned with equality as they are with fairness. And I think this is kind of an interesting distinction that we can make. It's between really equality and equity. The one of the big reasons, and I come to really most topics really as an immigrant, as a person of color, and the history in the United States has been stacked against people of color for a long, long time. So what happens is that white folks have had the leg up for a very long time. You look at what happens, you know, in the 50s, you know, the GI Bill didn't really apply to people of color. There were restrictive covenants and deeds. There was redlining. So that started to create a wealth gap. And the wealth gap is really, really huge mm-hmm. between white people and people of color. So right now you say, well, and now you can go and buy wherever you want. Well, now it's too late because you can't afford it and you don't have that accumulated wealth and you don't have that inheritance that a lot of families were privileged to have. So that's the distinction that we have to make between equality and equity. I mean, if people just go into a search engine and say equality versus equity, one of the things that you're going to get is this cartoon about three people standing at a wall, mm-hmm. and they're all of different heights. And the first picture is each of them get a block, and it's the same exact height. So they all stand on it. Some people can see over the wall, and some can't. That's equality. Everybody gets the same thing. Equity is when everybody gets a box that are of different heights to allow everybody to see over the wall. That's, I think, what we have to be concerned about here in Seattle. How do we make the city equitable, not equal, for everybody?
What do we do with that? Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's like fairness starts when? How far back do you start to look before you talk about who's being treated fairly? So that history of unfairness, what do we do with that information? How does that go to Pamela? How does that translate to now? What do we do with the history of a lack of fairness that we're already living in?
So some of the things that we've been looking at the Urban League, and then just looking at the HALA, there's a program in Portland, Oregon, where most of my family still lives, and it's trying to starve off the rest of the gentrification in the African American community. So there's a $4 million fund. They have a lottery open right now where 65 families, if you can prove that your grandparent and you're African American, because Portland is very black and white, they don't have a large other population there, that your family had property in North Northeast Portland in this geographic area, you can apply. The lottery's open now to get homeowners assistance, and you'll be the first ones back into the neighborhood. And it's a huge down payment assistance program. It's between $30,000 and $80,000. Now Portland's property values are kind of swinging upward like ours, not as fast, not because they're not as big. So I think we in the city have to get very creative on how to do things like that. I was on a panel with at an event where actually Mayor Murray was at, and he said to me, he's like, what do you think we could do to help, you know, black people get by back in the city? And I said, redline us back in. You redlined us in there before. Why don't we do something like that? And I was joking, but in the back of my mind, I had heard about this program in Northeast Portland. And so we have to get creative like that. We have to support stability programs for people that are getting, that have, you know, foreclosures. Foreclosures are still happening. People seem to think that they're not, but they are. We have to support that. Rental stability, we need programs to help people stabilize in their rents. And I think to get the word out that there is support like that, but we have to be creative because, again, what Zeki said, if you look at the history, if black people, when slavery ended, we got our 40 acres and a mill, we would have that equity in property, home ownership, generational wealth, assets in our community. But we didn't. And when you talk about that GI Bill and people don't understand that that thing happened at the federal level, it happened with mortgage companies, but it happened at the federal level where they were building out in the suburbs. Black people couldn't buy in the suburbs. And that's what happened, you know, in the inner city. We got into the ghettos. One of the reasons the Urban League is in existence is because of that, you know, phenomenon. Couldn't own property, couldn't, you know, get education, all of the things that happened, the Jim Crow, all of those things that happened in the 50s. So I think it's imperative that we do, you know, take some of the recommendations in the HALA, and we have to get creative. And again, it's public-private partnerships. I love that, you know, Bill's talking about getting creative when it comes to zoning. When I was out doorbelling, I saw the most unique detached accessory dwelling units in the Central District and plots of land where you could build a smaller home or you could do the mother-in-law's apartment. A lot of that has to do with zoning. It has to do with permitting and how long it takes to get things built in our city. Again, we have to attack the Seattle process because it takes too long.
Pamela, this one idea about this Portland program that gives a boost to African Americans, what do you say to somebody who's Japanese-American grandfather lost his land during World War II, and we could go on and on. How can we give somebody a boost and not start to get divisive?
I think when you start looking at, you can start looking at the data. So I go to the data. If you look at the data for African Americans, home ownership, wealth, the wealth gap is crazy big. If you look at graduation rates, if you look at incarceration rates, if you look at, you know, health disparities, you got to go to the data because everyone wants to see data. You talk about outcomes. And I think that's how you justify what's going on. And I think that's one of the things that the Black Lives Matter movement spurs. You have got to look at the data and the inequities. It's the structural racism. It's the institutional racism. People are able to talk about it now because of the data. When you think about the numbers of people that are coming out of prison, the disparate drug sentencing laws. I mean, we did some stuff here in the state legislature around the certificate of restoration and opportunity to help people get records sealed so that they can get into subsidized housing and they can qualify for student loans. But that's what you have to do. You go to the data.
Zeki Hamid, you got any dispute with that?
No, I don't. I think the data is very, very clear, especially when you talked about mass incarceration. Here's one glaring statistics, and I got this. This is only for the city of Chicago, but it really can apply to the rest of the country. The arrest rate is 2-1 between Black and white, but the conviction rate is 50-1.
Okay, we're going to talk about America being whole or being divided more when we talk about the presidential campaign here in a few minutes. And we're also going to talk about cheerleading, right? Husky cheerleaders in the news. Can we have cheerleading at all without being all kind of exclusive? And how would we do that? That's all coming up on the Week in Review. On KUOW's Week in Review, your team is Pamela Banks, Bill Finkbeiner, Zeki Hamid. I'm just cheering them on. I'm Bill Radke. Last week, the University of Washington removed a photo from its Facebook page. It was an infographic showing how women trying out for the Husky cheerleading team ought to look. In the photo, a white woman with blonde hair poses in shorts and a sports bra, and the text says, "Cheerleaders should have a bronze beachy glow, false lashes, girl about town lipstick, flattering eyeshadow." It goes on to say that natural or spray tan is good, but not dark, smoky eyes or too much makeup. Also, no nude lips, etc. Critics call this objectifying, sexist, and/or racist. But, you know, Washington State University has a similar infographic, and the cheer squad coach there, Chris Oppheim, doesn't see the problem. He says it's just giving you the dress code.
Well, in the world of cheerleading, there's lots of looks. In competitive cheerleading, there's a lot of glitter. In the world of high school cheer, there isn't as much. And in the world of college cheer, there's a certain look as well. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to help out these high school cheerleaders, these all-star competitive cheerleaders. You're trying to help them out to know, you know, what the look of college cheerleading is, and specifically more so what the look of WSU cheerleading is.
So we have cheerleading. This is just information. Pamela, you were a high school cheerleader, I just found out, who tried out for the Husky team.
Many moons ago.
It was just yesterday. What did you think when you saw the UW poster?
I was offended. I'm 5'1", and I am African-American and Asian, so I definitely don't meet the height requirements, but I'm hecka cute, and I don't have to wear makeup. So. I was appalled because it goes back to self-image and what we're trying to display for women. And so I saw that is the standard. You know, and I have my quotes up, beauty in America today. And I don't think our America, and I definitely know our Seattle doesn't look like that. And when someone asked me about the Wazoo coach saying that, I'm like, well, think about who's living in, you know, Wazoo land versus who's living in Seattle land. And I think that that's why we got this big outpouring of people saying that this is totally not right.
Are we just talking about the photo happening? They picked one person for the photo.
Right.
They didn't have to do that. They could have picked more, but they chose this white woman with blonde hair. Mm-hmm. Is that the problem? Or I'm trying to figure out what, because cheerleading is so weird to me in a way anyway, that what part of cheerleading could we choose and improve on? What would you do differently?
You know, cheerleading is athletic. I mean, when I was the smallest on my cheer squad, so I was always on top of the pyramid because I was so small and they could like throw me in the air and all that good stuff. But I think now when you look at it, it is a sport. I mean, ESPN has it on. I don't know if you ever watched it, but you have to, you know, it's gymnastic. It's all of that. I think it has more to do with with that look. Like, what is that look of a college cheerleader? What is she supposed to look like? If you go down south, if you look at their cheer squads, you see African Americans, you see Asian, you see women of color. And I think that that's the point here, is that that standard blonde, blue-eyed, you know, if she was, you know, very model looking like in the thing with the little sports bra and the little shorts, I think that that was borderline sexist to me. I didn't like the look, and I didn't like that it came out from the school that I went to, that I proudly wear purple every Friday, you know, that kind of thing. It just really, it did annoy me.
So if the Husky cheer squad admits a cheerleading team that reflects the applicant pool, and they choose a different photo for their infographic, then you're good?
Yeah. Okay. I think for me it was more of that the because it goes back to the self-image of people, right? And if, say, a young immigrant girl wanted to come out to the cheer squad, but and maybe she's Muslim, she can't dress like that. So
exactly.
That would discourage her. So that's my thing.
That's interesting.
Yeah, do you think about that? She couldn't go practice like that, you know? And so that's what it came for me when I thought about that. I was like, this is not right, because everybody doesn't have that opportunity, be it religious, be it income, because, you know, it's an expensive sport, that kind of thing.
Exactly. But, Zaki, how would you want to be, just in that example, inclusive of Muslims on a cheerleading squad?
Well, here's the thing. I just want to make a quick distinction between cheerleading for pro sports and college, because pro sports, that's just absolutely ridiculous. I don't know why we have it. There's nothing there to me that's athletic or anything like that. It's just a bunch of women dancing around. I there's six NFL teams that have done without cheerleading squads. I applaud them. I hope the Seahawks can sometime follow that. But for colleges, they are, you know, definitely athletic. They, like I say, they have the pyramids, stuff like that. It's gymnastics. It's fantastic. But the problem here is that they're creating a very specific standard of beauty. And if somebody comes that doesn't quite look like that but can perform all of this, they're saying that you probably won't be coming in. Now, as for...
But are we back to talking about that one blonde Husky photo? If we changed the photo, and if teams look like their applicant pool, I don't know if the cheerleading squads do or not, then have we solved the problem with cheerleading?
No, we haven't. Because my problem is that we are still creating a very, you know, a standard of beauty. You have to look a very specific way. So you can put, you know, a Muslim girl there, you can put a black girl there, you can put a white girl there. It's still the very same standard of beauty. And like Pamela said, it's very difficult for Muslim women. It's very difficult for Muslim women to participate in sports, period. In the Olympics, it always comes up that they have to get special permission to wear their hijab while competing in their sports. So that's always been a problem.
Bill Finkbeiner, what, if anything, would you do to the institution of cheerleading? You wave your wand. What would we do to make it right, if anything?
Boy, it's such an interesting, and I never really thought about it that much until I heard that it was going to be a topic for today. And it is such a sport. Clearly, it requires incredible athleticism, and the competitions now, especially at the high school and college level, are incredible. But it's also the only sport that's sort of an adjunct to other sports.
Right.
It doesn't have its own events. There's clearly a part of it that is sort of, you know, that is appearance based. I mean, and all sports really, there's a lot of it that's appearance based. Probably cheerleading way more so, but you know. Football uniforms is a huge business. It's a huge deal, right? Look, when every year they release the new uniforms for the, you know, Oregon Ducks.
Right, because looks matter a lot in football and other sports.
Yeah, they do. And all sports, they all have different styles, and their uniforms matter, right? But probably it's more that way in cheerleading. So I don't know. I think I was also thinking, like, sports is sort of, it's a replacement for warfare in a way, right? It's sort of like it's combat without anything, you know, hopefully really bad happening. And then cheerleading's kind of like, it's sort of a representation. I mean, you sort of need, and there's a reason people are sitting in the stands, right? And so, I don't know. Anyway, I'm sort of lots of different thoughts about it, but it's an interesting area that people hadn't really thought about till that picture came out. So
Pamela,
it's a discussion.
Yeah, we'll give you the last word, but Bill is getting at something here, I think, with the idea that it's not complete. There are ESPN cheerleading competitions, but at its base, we all know that it's right in there, cheer. You're saying cheer for these other people who are playing this sport. So is the and we want the crowd to have a reaction, and we want the crowd, and looks matter, and can we extricate all this superficiality away out of cheerleading and make it, what would you do to make it the best it could be?
I'm with Zeki. Like, at the professional level, I would, like, do away with it because I don't think it has anything to do with the sport. But for, you know, high school and for college, I think it's more about spirit in the team and supporting your team, right? Mm-hmm. And so, again, for me, I would like to say do away with it at the professional sport level and more focus it on a fun activity for young men and women who may not be athletic enough to make the team but want to support their team, more like a pep squad or something like that.
Yeah, it sounds like a pep rally, but that should be incorporated. Just diversify it more and big it up more at the games itself.
Yeah. I mean, I don't. To me, you know it. When I think about my time, and I didn't make the cheer squad. I was too short. After you.
Is that okay? Should
no.
we not have...
No, but, that, well, you know, I should, wanted to be a flight attendant, and I was too short. And, you know, so, you know, that just comes with... That was the hand I dealt, right? Not dealt. But so I just... For me, it's just... It's not... I mean, I could do away with it at the college level. It's just a way to generate spirit at the high school level. I mean, really, I don't think it's necessary. Personally, to be college level, I think high school is cool. You know, it's something you do. It was fun. It was really great to do that when I was in high school. But I did it only in basketball because it was too cold to be outside for football. But I was a statistician for football, so I had a choice, right? And I got paid to be the statistician, where you didn't get to be paid to be a cheerleader. So I kind of did both, and that probably is why I'm so sports minded. But again, I just don't think it's necessary. I think it's really unnecessary.
Okay, we got to move on. Sorry, Seagulls and Huskies and Cougars and et cetera. We've walked cheerleading now down to the high school level, and who knows where it goes from there. Coming up, Trump and the future next. This week, the last two Republican presidential candidates challenging Donald Trump dropped out, which leaves the party split. The state GOP chair, Susan Hutchison, says Trump is going to help Washington Republicans.
More than ever, we've got an opportunity to not only take the House, but also to take the governor's race and to win the Senate race and other statewide races, simply because we're going to be getting a huge group of voters who have felt disenfranchised.
But other Republicans in Washington see a whole different reality. A lot of leading Washington Republicans are not falling in with Trump. This is U.S. Senate candidate Chris Vance.
I've been a Republican all my life. But, you know, Bill, I'm a member of the party of Abraham Lincoln and Theodore Roosevelt and Dwight Eisenhower and Ronald Reagan and Dan Evans and Slade Gorton and Jennifer Dunn. And this nominee does not fit with that legacy. I think after November, there's going to be a reckoning and a major discussion about the future of the Republican Party. But for right now, it's about winning elections.
A reckoning, Bill Finkbeiner. You were the Republican majority leader in the state Senate. What's going to happen? What's that reckoning? What happens to your party?
Boy, I don't know. It's going to be, you know, an interesting, not just 6 months, but I think year or 2 years. I mean, this is clearly just ripping the Republican Party apart, and it's dysfunctional right now.
But do you think it's temporary and it's zipped back up? You don't think so?
I don't think so.
Republican Party breaks up?
I don't know if it breaks up. I mean, I think it could. You know, you've got the Speaker of the House at the federal level today said he can't
Paul
support
Ryan.
The nominee. Yeah, that's a big deal. And I don't, you know, I think we need at least two functional parties for sort of our system of government to work well. And I think, you know, I think it's a little disconcerting. I mean, I think knock on wood, it'll all turn out fine in a year or two, but it's going to be some rough patches on the way there for sure.
Okay, that's important, Bill. You just said it's not just about the Republican Party. It's about our system of democracy.
I think so.
Zeki, what do you think happens to our democracy? You had strong feelings about this.
Yeah, so we are extremely polarized in this country. And I was talking to a political scientist from Wazoo a couple of weeks ago. And we were talking about polarization really as at a national level. But somebody asked a question about how polarized are we on the state level? And he said we are the third most polarized state in the country. Right now what's happening with the Republican Party is that it's moving closer to authoritarianism than it is to conservatism. And that's frightening. And that's not frightening because of Trump. That's frightening because of the people who support him. For me, as an immigrant, I got so many things going against me here. I'm an immigrant. I come from a Muslim tradition and a person of color. I mean, so if I'm going down the street and I literally saw this one time after 9/11 when somebody had thing on their truck that said nuke them all, right? So that was maybe an anomaly back then. Right now you're seeing a lot more hateful rhetoric come through. So that by itself is really frightening. But the other thing about our democracy, I agree with Bill, we need two strong parties in order to get anything done. And that's one of my points.
You just said we're polarized. I mean, we have two parties and it's not working, is it?
Because we are very closely divided. We've never been more closely divided. In the past, it was common for somebody to win by 15, 20, 25 points. And you look at the data and then you look at the small percentage. And that's why we're so politically polarized, because these are important issues and people are actually engaged. So I don't know what the solution is, but you need, people have to think about the word compromise. And compromise cannot be a dirty word. That's the only way that things can work in the United States.
So Trump's Washington campaign says he holds a public rally Saturday in Whatcom County in Linden. Will you go?
No, I don't want to go.
Even to, not to protest.
I'm not even to protest. I'm very against extremes. I don't like political purity and I don't like political extremes. That's why I don't support Donald Trump and that's why I don't support Bernie Sanders. And that's a very dirty thing to say in Seattle right now. So have at it, social media.
Pamela, do you want to react to that? Political purity?
I agree with Seki. I am not into extremes because you see what extremism has done in our history, and it's very scary.
But isn't that defining Bernie Sanders as extreme? You know, isn't it convenient for people who just don't support him?
No, because I think if you think of the socialist alternative party movement or just the socialist movement in general, it is extreme, and I don't think that you're going to get there in a country. I mean, if he were to make the nomination, which I highly doubt that he will. But if he did, he couldn't get anything done. They would block him worse than they blocked Obama getting things done.
Do you think Trump will be able to get nothing done if he were to become president?
I'm moving out of the country if you
do. You, some people, some
you
even
laugh,
some
I'm
Democrats, this is a minority point of view, but some Democrats say, and this is a purity thing, this is where we need to go next, is President Trump, because otherwise we get more of the same. These are Bernie Sanders, not all Bernie Sanders fans, but, you know, people who say, I don't want Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, but, you know, when you say that, I mean, that is a very privileged point of view to say,
absolutely,
let's burn the whole country down. So a lot of young people right now are saying, yeah, let's go. I'm going to vote for Trump and we're going to take this whole country down so the revolution can begin. Well, most of us are not 20-year-olds with nothing to lose. We have lives. We have families. We have jobs. We have houses. I don't want to burn the country down. And from an immigrant point of view, I did not move to this country for a revolution. I came from the Middle East. I've had enough revolution. I come here for stability, and that's what I'm looking for.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about how much looking back there's been in this campaign. Yesterday, Pat Buchanan, conservative commentator, told NPR that Trump has caught on because in 25 years, Americans of European descent will be a minority, and that Trump fans know that's a problem.
Well, because I look at Europe, and I look all over the world, and I see peoples everywhere at each other's throats over issues of ethnicity and identity. Again, the United States of America, we had an enormous success. We had high immigration from 1890 to 1920. Then we had a time out where all those folks from Eastern and Southern Europe were assimilated and Americanized. They learned English. I went to school with the sons and daughters of these folks, and we created a really united country where 97% of us spoke English in 1960. Now, in half the homes in California, people speak a language other than English in their own homes. Anybody that believes that a country can be maintained that has no ethnic core to it or no linguistic core to it, I believe, is naive in the extreme.
We need an ethnic core and an identity. Pat Buchanan says, look at Europe, it's ripped apart, etc. How do you react?
Yeah, so really quickly, I want to talk about the difference between the United States and Europe, again, from an immigrant perspective, right? So I moved to the United States in 1994, and in 2001, I got my citizenship. What happened when I got my citizenship? I just became an American. Everybody accepts me as a fellow American. I am protected by the Constitution, and the vast majority of people in this country support that. For every one negative interaction I might have with somebody, I have 9 others that are extremely positive. If I move to France, I would still be an Arab. I would never be French, even if I got my citizenship. Mm-hmm. That's a huge difference between the United States and Europe. And so the model in the United States works because we are a nation of immigrants. That's how we were built.
Trump says he will make America great again. I want to get at the nostalgia part here of Pat Buchanan's comments and others like him who give various reasons for why we're going to make America great again, like it used to be. So you have Trump saying we've fallen and we'll get back there. Even Hillary Clinton has been using the phrase we're going to make America whole again. So I think she's talking about being united, as you just said, Zeki, about not standing against one another. But still, this idea that we're going to get back to the way we were before is something that Evergreen State College professor Stephanie Kuntz talked about on KUOW this week. She said, be careful anytime you're getting nostalgic.
Trump says, let's make America great again. And Hillary Clinton answers, let's make America whole again. And I just wonder where in the past they think they can go back to do that. I think Trump thinks about the greatness of the 60s and 70s when we were the major player in the world. And you know, that's not going to come back unless we are prepared to do a whole lot of changes in our economic and political structure. And it's certainly not going to come back militarily because we just no longer have the only game in town. And I think Clinton wants to go back to the 90s, but that was the era when the Confederate flag flew over most of the state capitals in the South. You were getting all of this talk about super predators. You got a reform of welfare laws, which has left more people living in extreme poverty than were living in extreme poverty at that time. And you didn't even have climate change on the agenda, really, at that time. So there's all these sort of new problems we have to step forward and meet, and new gains, such as the real increase in interpersonal democracy and respect for children's rights and for women's rights and for gay and lesbian rights that we didn't have then. So we can build on the victories of the past, but we should not pretend we can go back to the past.
Bill Finkbeiner, was there ever a time when America was better than it is now in any sense that we want to get back to?
There's always pieces of history where, you know, things were in one small piece or this small piece can be better. But I absolutely think that we've made huge strides as a country. And I think that's one of the things, the story that America, I think, is at its best when it tells is a story of being a melting pot and a story of looking to the future and striving to continually improve. I think that's always been something that America has looked towards. And when people say, let's go back to the 60s and 70s, it's like, oh, yeah, the Cold War when, you know, we had two leaders of the world who have their finger on the button and can pretty much end civilization at any moment. Was that, you know, a better time? When you look at the number of people who have moved out of poverty worldwide in the last decade, it's astronomical. I mean, I just feel like there's so much more to be optimistic about and so much more to be proud of progress that we've made, as opposed to, you know, saying to go back to these times.
Pamela Banks, do you have any use for nostalgia? Is there anything about America's past you do want to go back to?
Not at all. I mean, I think about, if you think about the 50s, there were Jim Crow laws, right? You think about the 60s, we barely got civil rights passed, and we wouldn't have done that without our, you know, our Jewish and our white allies. So for African-American people, I would say no. I think that I'm back with, you know, really appreciating the melting pot that we do have in our country, but especially in the city, because I worked in city government for 30 years, and I remember when the Southeast Asians moved in and how the city opened up. That's when we started doing translations and interpretations, and we started really reaching out to the new immigrants, and now we're doing it with our East African and our Muslim people moving into this country. And so for me, when I hear that, I'm like, that is a statement that comes from people that have privilege. And that's what it goes to. When Donald Trump first had that on a hat, I was like, that's coming from peer privilege, and that does not represent this country, and it definitely does not represent our city.
This idea of nostalgia, by the way, reminds me of the discussion circling way back to several minutes ago. We were talking about Seattle changing and diversifying, and remember when the report came out that Seattle's suburban nature had racist underpinnings? We had this whole conversation about whether wanting to keep Seattle the way it is has a privileged racist component. What do you think of that?
I think that given how gentrification has played out in neighborhoods. I think that that is true. But I think that if we truly work together, and we're a very smart city, we're a very wealthy city, that we can really stop that. And I think that I would like to see us be that model in the country versus turn it into San Francisco.
Pamela Banks, the CEO and president of the Urban League. Bill Finkbeiner, are you going to quit the Republican Party? Because this would be a time on the air right now to tell us to do that.
I mean, and it's a long discussion because I've never been a super huge fan of either one of the parties, frankly. You know, I've said before on a couple months ago on your show that there's no way that I could vote for Trump. But it definitely pushes me further away from the Republican Party, I'd say. One thing I wanted to say, too, is the one part that I think we all are nostalgic for is back when we had the Sonics here.
Yes.
This entire show has been related, if you think about it, has been thematic. I didn't think about that. There is a definite when I pictured Sean Kemp, there's a hazy glow around him.
Absolutely.
What do you think of all these questions, Jackie, about?
I want to talk a little bit about public memory. I'm a humanities guy, so I come from this, philosophy and ethics and history and so forth. So we did at Humanities Washington this event last year in Yakima. We talked about public memory. And there was
public memory, yeah.
Public memory, exactly. And some of the takeaways that I got out of this is public memory can be about three things. It can be about forgetting or excluding an alternative past, which is, Pamela, you talked about that. It could be about creating and reinforcing patriotism. And it could be about developing a sense of nostalgia to legitimize a particular heritage. So I found these two quotes that I think are great. One is from John Quincy Adams, and he says, "Democracy has no monument. It strikes no medals. It bears the head of no man on a coin." And the other one's by Emerson, where he says, "Americans were emancipated from history, happily bereft of ancestry, untouched and undefiled by the usual inheritance of family and race." So back in the antebellum era, you could argue that Americans looked to the future. Constantly looking to the future. And now all of a sudden, we keep looking at the past, and both parties do it. I remember in 2004, everybody in the Democrats were saying, take our country back. And so in 2008, take our country back. In the past, as I said, it was looking to the future, and boy, is it different now.
Well, then let me ask you, because we've got just like a minute left, but given that America is coming out of the greatest bull market in many senses in history, It is a time, like it or not, there's some nostalgia out there. It's in some of the voters' minds. So what, in a few seconds, what do you do about that fact?
Adapt. You just adapt.
How do you frame it so you're telling voters something that they want to hear about the past and the future?
That's very difficult. That's a politician's problem there. How do you do that?
It in 1 minute. Okay, let's pause there on the Week in Review. I'm so glad you've been here. Zeki Hamid, Program Director for Humanities Washington. Pamela Banks, President, CEO of the Urban League. Bill Finkbeiner, former Republican. What did you say? You're quitting the Republican Party or not? What did you decide? Still a Republican? Okay. For now, small r, State Senate Majority Leader in Washington State. And this has been the Week in Review, live tweeting at KUOW. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.